is CoDiscovery. Hello, welcome to this episode of CoDiscovery with me, Abigail Acton. There are so many stories of how damaging our digital lives can be, from promoting unrealistic lifestyle goals to the skewing of elections. So this episode, we're shifting the narrative. We'll be taking a look at three applications that make a real difference to people's lives. This is where our impulse to perform random acts of kindness meets the power of AI. Our three guests, whose projects have been supported by the EU's Horizon 2020 programme, are here to share the results. A very warm welcome to Christian Erfurt, who launched his first healthcare startup while still in high school. Christian is co-founder and CEO of Be My Eyes, an app that pairs sighted volunteers with visually impaired users to help them deal with day-to-day challenges. Good morning, Christian.
Good morning, Abigail. Thank you for having me.
Christos Danos is Research Director at the Decision Support Systems Laboratory at the National Technical University in Athens. He is the coordinator of the Child Rescue Project, a collective awareness platform used to find and rescue missing children. Welcome, Christos.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Francesco Saverio Nucci was the coordinator of the Fandango Project, an Italian mathematician and researcher and innovation manager. Francesco graduated in artificial intelligence at the University of Rome, La Sapienza. He is Applications Research Director at the Italian company Engineering. Welcome, Francesco.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Excellent. Well, welcome to the three of you. And I'm going to turn to Christian first with my questions. Christian, Be My Eyes pairs visually impaired users up with volunteers who help them with specific tasks. Could you tell us how it works and how many people are using it, actually?
Absolutely. Be My Eyes is an app connecting blind and visually impaired people to sighted volunteers by the press of a button. So you download the same app, sign up as a blind user, and we match to your volunteer in an overlapping time zone in the same native language as you speak. So you don't have to worry about disturbing someone. And we call in batches of 8 to 10 people. So the first one available is actually someone who actively decided to step in and take the call. It's a two-way audio, one-way video. Backside of the camera is turned on, and you can see what the blind or visually impaired person are struggling to see. It's currently in 150 countries. We have 5.5 million volunteers who have joined the platform over the years, and 350,000 blind or visually impaired people have signed up since we launched in 2015.
That's an incredible number. It's very, very impressive, particularly the volunteer base. That's huge. What do you think the motivation is for volunteers? Why are people signing up?
I think that there is a very clear call to action for both sides of the equation. You can clearly see it from the blind person's perspective. But for the volunteers, it seems like it's being part of a solution. You know, to do that small micro-volunteering act of kindness, it's very gratifying to be part of that exchange. One of our users actually said, "It feels like a good deed waiting to happen in my pocket."
Excellent. Yeah, that's a good description. I can imagine that. And also, I suppose it's really seamless. So the phone goes. If you're the volunteer, you decide whether to take the call or not. I guess that's how it works, yes.
Exactly. Yeah. You just sign up and it will ring at some point. And if you're in a place and time for answering it, you can answer and help with anything from distinguishing products, shopping, navigation. You know, technology is great, but a GPS can only take us so far. Google Maps will take you to a location, but not necessarily show you where the door is. So we've seen all kinds of use cases all around the world.
Right, absolutely. And so the blind person uses their camera to show what it is that they're struggling with and gets talked through the solution.
Exactly.
That's excellent. So Christian, is it free for the blind users? I'm sure the volunteers don't have to pay anything. How does this work in terms of monetization, or is there no money involved at all?
It's a very good question. And Be My Eyes is absolutely free for all of our users, the blind and visually impaired and our volunteers. We've always set out to have a product that would be globally available and free for all of our users, which is a challenge to, you know, you have to keep the lights on. So how do we come up with a business model? And we have a very strong design sentence saying everybody wins only when nobody loses. And we dared to aim to build a business around that design sentence. And for the first 3 years, we didn't know how to do so. But actually, it was a collaboration with Microsoft that led to the business model. And that is that today, Be My Eyes is enabling companies to provide accessible customer support, and the companies are paying us. to do so. So they simply gain access to our community, and we enable them to have a video line established directly into their customer support center via our app. So you could say that it's accessible customer support, and we are providing the video connection for them, which makes it a lot easier to, you know, troubleshoot a product. It could be, you know, it's difficult enough to install a router for a sighted, but if you know what light is blinking, is the power on, all of that, the troubleshooting is just a lot faster when they have the video model in place. So Microsoft was the first customer to join for all of their Windows products, all of their Microsoft, any kind of product, really. And I think what was fascinating was that immediately they invited Google to come and join and see how they were doing it. So they didn't want to use this as a competitive advantage. They said, this is such a great movement that we need more companies to join. So they invited a competitor into, you know, the belly of the beast of their customer support center.
Oh, that's really impressive. You're right, because that sort of stuff is normally jealously guarded, huh?
Exactly. And these have been some of our biggest advocates in getting new customers on board. So today we're doing, you know, in... we're doing healthcare and transportation. We're doing tech support, e-commerce. And I think it's because of the companies are not only solving the problem and it's faster than the traditional way of just an audio connection, but more interestingly, they get an insight to where the products are not working from an accessible perspective.
Right.
So you could say, you know, it's an insight to the customer journey and what they need to fix for the millions who are not calling in.
Right. So that's great because it's like real-time feedback, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Thank you. Has the success of this concept inspired you to think of developing other tools?
I think in general that the combination of purpose and profit is absolutely probably the strongest competitive advantage going forward. All of us as consumers, we want to be part of solutions rather than problems. So I think that this should inspire others to do purpose and profit as a combination. In the sake of Be My Eyes, we are sliding into verticals such as colorblindness and dyslexia and also aging eyes, supporting people who just don't necessarily understand the situation they're struggling with to see. So, but I think we'll see a lot more of this micro-volunteering movement in the future.
Well, I think you're right. It taps into something quite fundamental within us, I think. And it brings the power of digital communication to that, making it so much more widespread, so much easier to do a lot of good rather than just a small thing next door for a neighbor or something. Fantastic. Excellent. Does anyone have any questions for Christian, please? Yes, Christos.
Well, Christian, I'm really fascinated by your project and the results it has. And I really wonder, how do you validate the volunteers in order to be certain that they're safe to provide their services to the ones that need it?
It's a great question, Christos, and thank you for asking it. We actually give everybody the benefit of the doubt. So we don't validate them. We don't do a background check for them to join. Anyone can have a chance at joining the Be My Eyes community. And we will, you know, act on any abuse reports. But this is a beautiful engagement that happens. And it happens, as I said, in 150 countries and 185 different languages. And we rarely see any kind of problems with the input from the volunteers. You know, we do see some prank calls from now in time to then that someone will sign up. But I think the community is really defending the model and saying you're ruining it for the many instead of blaming Be My Eyes as a concept, which is, I think, is also a powerful thing to have, is that your community is kind of defending the very basics of how it works. So we don't validate them. We don't background check anyone. They get the benefit of the doubt. Everybody's welcome to join.
Well, given that it's over the telephone as well, and it's not immediate contact, so prank calls, I imagine nuisance calls is pretty much where, you know, as bad as it could get. No, that makes a lot of sense. And I like the idea of peer-to-peer regulation as well.
And you can say that because you don't have, you can introduce yourself with your location and name and everything, but it is actually in some sense anonymous, because you connect and someone who speaks the same native language as you do will answer the call, but they don't have to know anything about you. You can just ask for, you know, product distinguishing, or I'm saying I need to color coordinate this outfit or find the entrance to the metro, and then hang up. But we also see the communication where, coming back to the greater good of it, is that they understand what it's like to have a visual impairment as a volunteer. And that might make you more, you might approach someone in real life more easily now that you know that, you know, we're not that different.
Yes, indeed. Bringing down barriers generally. Excellent. Christos, I'll come to you now. Thank you for that last question that you asked. Now you're in the chair. The Child Rescue Project created a web platform and a mobile app that uses machine learning to help organizations locate missing children. So, Christos, there are alert systems in place already. How does Child Rescue improve on them?
Well, currently, the most widespread system is the Amber Alert system, a very famous one. And it's a very successful system currently in place in most EU countries. The public is notified through a nationwide TV and radio broadcast, but also posters, flyers, electronic message boards, signs, public announcements, and other means. So if a child has gone missing in a public part, apart from the active search by the police and authorized volunteers, you expect that the information will come from people who have seen a picture in an alert or and have identified the missing child. But the alert will play on your TV at home, where you may or may not have paid attention to it before or after you go to that park where the child has gone missing. But it's not when you're there. Then we also quickly forget faces. In just a few minutes, most of us can't recognize a person whose picture we just saw. The radio broadcast and the public announcements don't have a picture, neither does the message board. And on top of that, you may be watching a picture of a child that has gone missing half an hour ago in a park which is 500 kilometers away. So you should be able to notify the people who are likely somewhere near the child at the time when their eyes, their senses are most useful for the investigation. We need to tell people to actively keep an eye for a child whose life may be at risk right then and there. And if new information comes available, to be able to tell people elsewhere, right where and when it matters most. So this is more or less the main idea of where Child Rescue started from.
So it's like targeting the alert to the people who are most likely to be able to do something about it and targeting it at the right time as well.
Correct. So the main public-facing tool of Child Rescue is a mobile app, which everyone in Greece and Belgium can get from both Android and iOS. The app simply sends a notification with a picture and a few details only if a child has gone missing and is somewhere, probably somewhere near the location of the person receiving it. So this is done without even knowing where your mobile phone is. We send the notification to all the phones and the area we want to the notification is shown is selected from the phone itself. So that's a technique called geofencing. So we don't need to know people's actual locations. So behind the scenes, the Child Rescue Platforms allows organizations from the Missing Children Europe network to combine information from multiple sources about a missing child and using advanced analytics and machine learning to suggest points of interest for the investigation and send notifications to citizens who have the app around these areas.
So can I ask you a little bit what you mean about advanced learning? I mean, how exactly does that work? Could you explain that a little bit, break that down a bit? How does that function, the computer learning?
The way that the application is working is a two-way street. So you get information from the citizens and from other sources, either the police or usually the family of the missing child, and you use that information in order to point certain areas on a map and possible routes that may connect those areas on the map. So you use that alongside other geographical information that has to do with speed of travel based on the means of transportation in that area. And so you either widen the area, create new points of interest, and basically pinpoint the locations where possible searches or notifications could be sent. The way that this is implemented is always leaving the decision to a human that will make it, and using that decision to either send notifications to the suggested areas or send volunteers in those areas.
Okay, that sounds excellent. I'm seeing something. I mean, to have an example, imagine then that a child goes missing somewhere relatively close to a motorway. Then I guess the pinpoint would be wider because the speed of distance would be easier because everything's traveling fast. And maybe places of interest would be things like service stations and motorway cafes. Is that the kind of thing that we're thinking here?
Yes, it's exactly that. And even more than that, it has also to do with information that is inputted to the system, like common places where the child has been spotted, that places of interest like friends' houses, families' houses, and points of interest on that route, like bus stations and train stations and the like.
Okay, it sounds fantastic. It sounds so much more efficient and more powerful than the existing method that you described at the beginning, the Amber Alert concept. So anyone can download the app, as you've just mentioned. It's available for Android and for iOS. Who uploads the information? So are you saying, for example, that it's the police and the missing children's organizations that upload the information to find the child, I guess? Or can the parents of the missing child directly upload information?
We do not ask that kind of treatment from the parents. The coordination of the search is between the police, the family, and generally authorities. Authorities are not directly linked to child rescue. So we only ask for citizens' awareness from the mobile app on behalf of the missing children organizations for the country and nothing more. Each organization who is responsible in its country to handle these incidents handles these data. The citizens aren't even told what area the notification was sent to. That was to avoid what we call mob justice, the possibility that you have a group of people joining and then going on and trying to locate the child. And if that's a criminal missing case, it may lead to a certain difficulties that have to do with people taking the law in their own hands.
Right, yes.
So in order to avoid that, we do not give but the minimum of information to the citizens. So what we want them is to send facts, as we call them, in the system. And it's any kind of information that is relevant to the case, which may be either anonymously or eponymously a photograph, a piece of text, a sighting, a description, anything. So currently, we also use the platform to coordinate volunteers in Belgium. For them, it's a different app, basically, that one. That's a different app specifically for the volunteers that helps them to define active search areas. And in those areas, the volunteers can coordinate searches, including with specially trained dogs, distributing flyers and putting up posters, pinpointing the locations to retrieve them when the investigation is over. Privacy is a very important issue for child rescue, because we're talking about children's information, and if it goes out, especially in the internet,
right,
then it never leaves it. So what we do is to try to have that information located only in mobile phones where it matters, and when the investigation is over, that information is securely deleted from each and every place, including the flyers where the volunteers know where they've put them up, and they went back to take them down.
No, that sounds like it's covering all possible aspects of intrusion very, very well indeed. Given the fact that it's so robust and so on, can you have some statistics of users? Do you know how many people have downloaded it, and how many children have actually been found with this?
Now we have over 20,000 users in Belgium and Greece, which is very good for a research project. And it's actively used in both countries alongside the standard practices employed by the missing children organizations to assist police in the investigation. In the first 6 months of the operation of child rescue between September 2020 and March 2021, we already had it in 40 real-life cases in Belgium by the organization Child Focus that handles Amber Alerts there. And between September and March 2021, that was also for 30 real-life cases for the Smile of the Child in Greece. Now, from the children that were lost in Greece, every single one of them was found. And from the 40 life real life cases in Belgium, 32 were found during that time. We don't have all the information because that's again an issue of privacy and active investigations, but it actually got quite a few facts that were sent by the general public, especially in Belgium, where it received 62 facts by the public at that time.
Well, that would have been of great use in the hunt for those children. It must be immensely satisfying to know that you're producing something with such practical, tangible benefit.
We are really hoping that in some way we are managing to make the investigation just a little bit faster, because we all know that in investigations of missing persons, the first 24 hours are the most crucial ones. And so every minute counts when looking for a missing child.
Yes, indeed. And Christos, you've mentioned Belgium and you've mentioned Greece. Belgium and Greece, what about other countries?
It is currently open to any other country that wishes to engage with the existing platform, and they are free to join. We have started communicating our results to the other members of the Missing Children Europe network, and every organization in that network that has the authority to join the investigations through the Child Rescue is free to ask for more information in order to get a demo account to start from, to see how it works, how it operates. It's based in a more or less non-profit fashion, because it needs to be sustained in some fashion, since the project is over and the European funding is over.
Yes, of course.
So in order to sustain it, there is a minimum requirement that will be communicated when you join the network.
Right. Yes, that makes sense. As Christian said earlier, you have to keep the lights on.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Does anyone have any questions for Christos? Yes, Francesco.
Yeah, Christos. This is very interesting. My question is about the people's reaction in using artificial intelligence in this very sensitive. What is your feeling in the investigation, but also the family? And specifically, I've seen in my project that we will talk later about that there is, in my experience, we need the explicability. When the machine learning algorithm give you some suggestion, in my experiences, the people would like to know why. What is your experiences about this?
You're absolutely right about the explicability. It needs AI needs to make clear why it asks and why it does something. The way that we've treated it, since it's a very, very sensitive issue, is that we keep the AI as back in the process and with as many filters by humans as possible. So as we do say in decision support systems, it's the decision maker who makes the decision. It's a person. It's an actual person who makes that decision and not the system itself. We have everything documented as to how AI is used in the platform. It's used in a way which only suggests areas of possible interest, and those areas are then reevaluated by the police and the missing children organization. All decisions that are made through the platform are made by humans.
I have a question.
Yes, Christian, what would you like to ask Christos?
So all these cases, kidnapping?
Well, almost none of them are kidnapping. Most of them are teens running away from home. And there are certain other cases that have to do with younger children that have gone missing in public parks or when visiting friends or anything like that. The truth of the matter is that the parents should not really be afraid that much. Of course, they should always be careful for the children, but it's true that it's very rare that a criminal abduction takes place with children in Europe.
Christos, thank you very much. It's a wonderful application, and I really hope other countries take you up on this, maybe with a little bit of publicity from this podcast, who knows? Fingers crossed for you and for the children, because it sounds like it's something that is really potentially a lifesaver. Francesco, moving to you now. Your project, Fandango, has some solutions when it comes to how we can assess what online news to trust. So can you tell us a little bit more about the context. What motivated you to develop a system that can identify suspect news?
The motivation was the importance to have an efficient way to communicate news in Europe. I mean, in every democracy process, it's very important to have the right information to decide. And when we started, this problem was not so urgent as now, because we started more than 5 years ago. But we, let me say, anticipate something that is now very, very urgent. And in the middle of the project, the COVID pandemic happens. And now we know that this is very important, not just for democracy, but also for the health. And it's incredible. So we are, let me say, the motivation was when we started, but now is even higher.
Yeah.
It's very important. And let me say that we absolutely not solved the problem, just started to find some solution.
I like this idea that you realized that this was something that really could go badly wrong in the very near future, given the power of the internet and communications there. Indeed. Okay, so what can Fandango do and how is it used, please?
Yeah, first of all, is absolutely in line with the Christos approach, because we cannot solve the problem, we cannot change the process with the journalist at the end. So we can just support the people that is checking the news, and we can try to give an easier way and a faster way to, because as Christos said, that in the child, the first day, the first 24 hours are important. In the news, the first 10 minutes are very important, because in other case, the fake news propagate, or the disinformation can propagate very, very fast. And so it's important to support the journalist in facilitate and in a more fast way their work. But the journalist should be at the end, in the loop. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. It's the person that makes the final decision. But how does this actually work? So I'm a journalist. I'm curious to see whether latest news about vaccines is reliable and robust or not. Tell me, how would I use your tool?
Yeah, we try to define four different dimensions in the fake news. The first one is the text, or in the news, in the communication. The first one is the text. So for the text, we try to use some machine learning in natural language processing, so analysis of the text to understand if there is something suspect. For instance, because you have in this information, you have some specific features in the text. For instance, a lot of adjectives or something like that. Then another dimension is naturally the image. And so we try to use machine learning algorithm to understand if an image has been manipulated. And during the project, again, we have seen this deep fake phenomenon. So we work in parallel for image and video to face the deep fake. But then we have another important part, that is the propagation, the sources and the propagation in the network, in the social networks of the disinformation. Again, we have seen that there is different kind of propagation for a fake news compared with the normal news. And so we try to understand, to use the machine learning to understand how this propagate and to identify some pattern of propagation of this information. All these services can be used by a journalist when he has some suspect or need to check some news.
So it's like a very precise cross-referencing to weed out the stuff that seems to be suspect.
Yeah.
Yes, I see that. So, but how? What absolutely does the journalist do? They're on their computer. What is this, a browser plugin? Is this an application? What do they put the text or the web page into some system that your project then analyzes? How does it actually work?
Yeah. This is a service, it's a web service, it's an application on the web. But it is depending also from the journalist, because when we say journalist, it's very large, different kind of people there. And let me mention that in the project, we have three different users. a news agency, an important ANSA, an important Italian news agency. So and they have some kind of way to work. Then we have a broadcaster from Belgium. This is again a media professional that are working in the broadcaster, and they try to include these services inside the newsroom for this broadcaster. And last but not least, we have a fact checker, a sort of fact checker that is a non-profit organization in Spain. And there is a lot of effort from the European Commission to support a network of fact checkers in Europe. And it's very important, but they have a different model compared with the journalists.
Okay, so the fact checkers, a major broadcaster, and we're talking here not about individual journalists who might be freelancing or autonomous in some way. You're talking about large news-generating organizations. Do you have plans to get it out onto the desktops of individuals who might simply be freelance journalists or writers?
Yeah, we tried to, let me say that at the start of the project, we have no idea of the project. We know what we would like to investigate, but we don't know about the model, for instance. We don't know if it can be possible to do something business to consumer for everyone. But we decided this approach to investigate more to large organization, not to individual journalists. I think that is more complicated for individual journalists, even more complicated for consumer, because naturally everyone say, okay, this is a system against fake news or to do fact checking, so I can use it. Because naturally this is a problem, not just for the journalists, but for every kind of citizen. But we decide to be more focused on the journalists and on the large organization, even if the fact checkers are not so large, but it's dedicated.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense, because if you're clarifying the validity of the news upstream, then the news that these larger organizations are disseminating is more likely to be robust and reliable. So that does sort of make sense. I can see what you're saying there.
Yeah, but even because this is also time of the budget, because we cannot do all, but we know that there are more projects in Europe, and more projects will become, because in the next work program we have a lot of attention about this. And so maybe putting all these pieces together, we can do also something for consumer, for the citizen.
Right. Excellent. Thank you very much. That sounds fascinating. I can see that there is a question from Christos. Christos, would you like to ask Francesco a question?
Yeah, Francesco, I'm really intrigued in the search for fake news and disinformation. And I'm following up a lot on what's going on with COVID disinformation and organized campaigns from state actors regarding disinformation. And I'm really wondering, how do you differentiate between disinformation that comes from individuals and disinformation and misinformation that comes from state actors and organized campaigns?
Good question. Naturally, I would like to say something about this. First of all, that we try in the project to be focused on some specific domain, that it was climate change, European policies and immigration. And this is something that, for instance, we can receive more from individual for the immigration, for instance, maybe something in climate change can be also from a larger organization. And disinformation is a very large problem with a lot of implication in terms of policies, but also in terms of relationship between countries. No, as you know. But naturally, this is something that we can see when we discuss about, when we investigate about propagation of fake news. So in that sense, you can have, you can try to understand if there is something that is coming from different organizations. But the problem with the fake news is the fact that they propagate, and maybe there is a fake news that came from a country, but then was being launched again from an individual. And there is also fake news that came, after 2 years, the same.
What do you mean by that, Francesco? Fake news that came after 2 years, the same? You mean that sometimes it rolls around again?
Yeah. Maybe also after 2 years or you can have a fake image that that is
resurfaces.
Yeah, resurface. Or this is a plane, a problem in the plane, and then you discover that this was an image of 10 years ago,
right?
Something like that. And there is organizations that are investigated about this. I'm not so expert about that, but for instance, NewsGuard as a sort of archive of fake news with the fingerprints. And this can be also very supporting.
Okay, that sounds particularly useful in this day and age and likely to get more and more useful as time goes on. Yeah. I think this problem is only going to get worse. It sounds a little bit like it's a fight between the AI tools used to identify and the fight between the AI tools used to generate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, listen, thank you very, very much, all three of you, for this fascinating discussion. I've really enjoyed this. And it's really positive, I think, to focus just every now and then on the use that we can put all of this technology to, rather than how detrimental it is all the time, seems to be what we hear mostly. So thank you very much for shining a more positive aspect onto this. Thank you to my three guests.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Are you interested in what other EU-funded projects are doing in the realm of ICT, digital technology, and how these tools can make our lives better? The Cordis website will give you an insight into the results of projects funded by the Horizon 2020 programme that are working in this area. The website has articles and interviews that explore the results of research being conducted in a very broad range of domains, from robotics to recycling. There's something there for you. Maybe you're involved in a project or would like to apply for funding. Take a look at what others are doing in your domain. So come and check out the research that's revealing what makes our world tick. We're always happy to hear from you. Drop us a line, editorial@cordis.europa.eu. Until next time.